Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. The best-selling author of Undercover of the Night recounts Laura Ackerson's disappearance and murder in North Carolina, the discovery of her remains in Texas, and the aftermath. On July 13, 2011, Laura Jean Ackerson of Kinston, North Carolina, went to pick up her two toddler sons. It would be the last time she was seen alive. 2 weeks later, detectives searching for the missing mother made a gruesome discovery on the shores of Oyster Creek near Richmond, Texas. The dismembered body parts of a young woman, whom they were able to identify as Laura Ackerson. Laura's ex, Grant Hayes, the father of her two sons, and his wife, Amanda, the mother of his newborn daughter, both pointed the finger at each other as the one guilty of murdering Laura, cutting up her body, and then transporting and disposing of the remains. This is the hauntingly true story of a devoted mother, a disturbed couple, and how these horrific events came to pass. The book that we're featuring this evening is Bitter Remains, A Custody Battle, A Gruesome Crime, and The Mother Who Paid the Ultimate Price. With my special guest, journalist and author, Diane Fanning, welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Diane Fanning.
Good evening, Dan. Hope you're doing well tonight.
I am doing very well. Thank you very much, Diane. For those out there, just for the record, Diane Fanning was our very, very first guest, and here she is once again with another soon-to-be true crime classic. So thank you very much, Dan. Let's set up this a little bit by, of course, you are a person that knows about all things Texan. So tell us a little bit where this area really is, this Oyster Creek, and before we talk about North Carolina, but where this is in Texas, and tell us a little bit about some of the two locations before we get into this macabre tale.
This is a location that is near Houston, Texas, and in between Houston and Katy, Texas. The Oyster Creek runs, ultimately feeds into the Gulf of Mexico, but it's a little ways in where the body parts were dumped. It's a very rural area, and not many houses along the road. And Laura was living in Kinston, North Carolina. Kinston's a small town, about an hour and a half out of Raleigh, and it was where Grant Hayes had been raised. And Laura was in a relationship with Grant Hayes for quite some time, and that's how she ended up in the town of Kinston.
Now, you talk about how the two met and a little bit of the background of Grant when we get originally into this story in the beginning of the book. So Grant is a musician, and you can tell us his race as well, which is important to this story. And tell us a little bit about how they met, under what circumstances did they meet, and the relationship developed, because very, very quickly, within a year, they're married. So tell us a little bit about Grant Hayes, and tell us about how they met before we talk about Laura.
Grant Hayes was a musician who performed at smaller venues for the most part, becoming a staple on the Raleigh music scene. And there were a lot of people who thought he was very talented. few disputed that when he was performing, he had a mountain of charisma going for him. He was an African-American man from Kinston, North Carolina, now living in Raleigh. He then was able to get work in the Virgin Islands and ultimately went there. But in Raleigh, he was performing one night, and Laura came to see the show and hang out at the venue, and she went backstage and met him that evening, and they just started seeing each other and discovered they had the same birthday in common, and Laura thought that was definitely a sign of fate. And that's how they ended up getting together. She believed in his talent. She started managing some of his bookings. And she then moved in with him. And they had a child named Grant Jr.
Now, we could talk about right after they got married, you say the honeymoon was over. And tell us, like, what you have in the book in terms of the kinds of requests, now that they were married, that he asked of Laura as to talk to his fans. What are the kind of requests that you have written in the book?
He wanted her to talk about sexual things with his fans. He basically wanted her to make them want him. And it was kind of a strange thing. He wanted her to lure in the female fans and to act very flirtatious and come-on-ish with the males. And he even wanted her to engage in sexual activity if it would further his career. And when she objected to some of the things he asked for, he told her, well, you're a white woman with a black man. Everybody knows you're trash.
Yeah, yeah. He also at this time, too, at this point even, is suffering from delusions. And in the form of, he thinks he's a time traveler and that there's beings and that the world will end in December 31st, 2012. So, and he also has this idea that he would like to be a polygamist. And this is early on. This is while she's still pregnant. He floats this polygamist idea. And you say, too, within 7 months or so after the wedding, he's meeting another woman, either pretending he's single or acting like he's single, another woman named Kristen. Tell us a little bit about the, to also demonstrate some things about his personality, Laura's friend Heidi Shoemaker. Tell us what that relationship was like and what did Grant think of it?
Grant told her that Heidi was a bad influence on her and did not want her to have anything to do with Heidi. And I think a lot of it was is that Grant was a very controlling personality. And in typical controlling manner, he tried to cut her off from the rest of the world. He didn't want her to have friends outside of his friends. He didn't want her to have much to do with her brother who was living in the area. He really wanted to have her under his control at all times. And he made things difficult for her. And unfortunately, Laura was lacking in the self-confidence and the past history of a functional family to be able to push this away and to understand it really had nothing to do with her. It was all about Grant. And she stuck with the relationship. I mean, she was about to have a child, and she did not want that child to be from a broken home as she was.
Now, it gets to the point, and there, other than delusions, there's also hard drug use like cocaine and possibly heroin, or at least cocaine at this time, and frequent drug use, and then the parties and things that are associated with musicians and playing in clubs occasionally, even to the point in where there's an intervention in 2009 by Grant's family, and he has some delusion about 50 kids in all races and some kind of empire. So tell us a little bit more about the kinds of characteristics that she's experienced in this first year of marriage and having a child, and what was he like, period?
He would do some very, very strange things. He had this philosophy of life that he came up with that was this strange amalgam of elements of Scientology, elements of Christianity, elements of alien beings taking over the government, and feeling that they were watching him and following him and trying to keep tabs on him. And he felt that he was one of the special people, and he had to accumulate wealth and build his empire because he was going to be one of the chosen ones to go to this special place when the world came to an end. And it reflected in his relationship with Laura, because he felt that she should go along with whatever he said should be done and whatever he believed. And if she got on his nerves, he would do some of the most bizarre things. Like one night he was shooting at her with the BB gun in front of a friend, and she was trying to get him to stop, and the only way she could get him to stop was to get out of the room, but in order to do that she had to go past him. And yes, she wasn't getting hit any place where it would do serious harm, but it hurt, and it was cruel. And he seemed to think it was all funny and no big deal. But how much of that was influenced by drugs and how much was just his defective personality is hard to tell.
Now, you chronicle in the book that Heidi and Laura's relationship is secret because Grant disapproves of it. But it gets to the point where Heidi gets a concealed weapons permit because they are caught together, and he warns them. And tell us about this warning. How serious is this warning so that she goes and gets a concealed weapons permit and then recommends that Laura gets one too? Tell us a little bit about this.
Well, they were getting together surreptitiously, and he just happened to come to the place that they had gone for dinner, and they were out in the parking lot, and he chastised Laura and said, you know, you're not supposed to be seeing her, and you know, you people ought to listen to me, because I know people who will snuff out your life so fast you won't know what happened. And I mean, he threatened to kill them if they didn't stop seeing each other. And he was pretty scary that evening, and that is what prompted Heidi to go and get a concealed carry license. And she wanted Laura to get one too, but Laura just didn't like guns at all and didn't want them around, so she bought Laura a knife.
Yeah. Now, tell us the circumstances in which, again, we talked about this guy's music career. Some people think he's quite talented, some people not so much. There's a lot of competition out there. He's not really paying the bills from this, but there seems to be some interest in this guy as a singer-songwriter. So tell us about this gig that he, or this phone call or this opportunity that comes from the Caribbean islands, from St. John, from a man. Tell us a little bit about this and then what happens as a result.
Well, Grant at one point was making a decent living as a musician, but then he started spending so much money on drugs that, you know, it ate it all up. And between that and his bar bills, there wasn't much left to bring home. And he got a call from a guy he had known a couple of years before, who was now down working in the entertainment field in St. John. And he was told that he could get as much work as he wanted down there. There were plenty of employment opportunities for musicians. So Grant went down there, and at that time, Laura had pretty much had it. And she was planning to leave him. And then shortly after he left, right before she was going to leave and head north, she found out she was pregnant for the second time. And when she found that out, she felt she had to go and try to make the relationship with Grant work. So she went back down to the Virgin Islands. That's where she discovered that he had met someone named Amanda Smith, who was someone who had a sufficient amount of money, and he convinced her that all it was, Amanda was his sugar mama, and she was going to help finance his career and help him get ahead. And he was only seeing her for the sake of his career and the betterment of his family.
Now, she had, when they met, you put in the numbers. So we're talking about almost $190,000 in cash she had for this inheritance. She had $77,000 in valuable jewelry. So $250,000 and in a short order. So what happens with Amanda? She goes back to New York. He is in... he's in the islands. Laura discovers that there's this other woman, and has to listen to his grand scheme that, listen, he's only doing it for the betterment of his own family, just to get ahead. So you say Laura goes back. Tell us the other procession.
Laura went back to the United States because their new baby, Gentle, was having a health problem, and it was felt the best thing to do is to go back to the United States to get him the help he needed, because it was thought that he was going to need some surgery, and this was something he was born with. And so she returned to the United States, and she kept waiting for Grant to come back too, but he didn't. And then when Amanda, who we'd met in the islands, moved back to Manhattan, Grant followed her and sort of came knocking at her door after she bought him an airline ticket. And they were living together in her apartment. And Laura didn't really know what was going on. She knew that he was in New York. And he kept saying it was just for the good of the family, and she wasn't really buying it anymore. But then he wanted to see their older son, little Grant, and have him up in New York for a photo shoot. Said he was going to do some commercial work with him, and he'd only be gone for 10 days. Well, Laura didn't want to let her little son go. She was feeling very protective and was concerned about Grant's motives. And so she just put it off and tried to put him off. And finally she relented and let him go up there. Well, the 10 days stretched to a month and to 2 months. Meanwhile, Grant's telling everyone up there that Laura is busy dealing with little Gentle's problems, and she wants him to keep little Grant longer, but that was blatantly untrue. And finally, Laura ended up going to court on her own without an attorney and filing to get her son back. As she did that, Grant called Child Protective Services on her and made up some stuff that wasn't true. And then he came down eventually with Grant, and when he did, he went to court and got an ex parte order, which means he's before a judge without the other party, and he asks for emergency custody of the two boys. Now, we already had Grant in his possession. So when the judge granted the emergency custody, poor little Gentle, who hardly knew his father, was pulled out of his mother's arms and taken away.
Yeah, incredible. Now, there's a couple people, other people that are important in here, especially a person named Siobhan Mathis. And so tell us about the relationship that Laura has with this other woman, because there's a different world that she has where people know her a certain way, and then her life with Grant. And we have to talk about the relationship, too. When you talk about she came back and was caring for her son, who had the kidney problem, in that Grant's parents are very helpful and active in the raising of these children, and even at that time, aren't they?
Yes, when she came back to the United States, she moved into a rental property that Grant's parents owned, and in exchange for her rent there, she cleaned up their daycare center each night. So because of that, of course, the children spent a lot of time around their grandparents and built up a close relationship with them at that time.
In this custody battle, we're talking about that Amanda was the only person really bringing in any serious money, and she also had these, you know, she was dedicated to Grant as well, and had some very traditional and traditional feelings, I mean, or traditional ideas, and also some strong feelings for Grant, and was paying what was amounting to a pretty enormous legal bill for this custody battle, wasn't it?
Yes, she was covering a lot of that, and before that, she'd gone through so much of her money, not just for the expenses of the custody battle. When Laura countersued on the custody agreement, the court ordered a complete psychological examination of both Grant and Laura, and that is quite an expensive thing, and she's paying for that. She's paying for Grant to go on trips to Hawaii and other places to look for performance opportunities. She's financing his expeditions to New York to try to sell his the cars he made for iPhones to Apple. He did some that apparently there was a lot of interest in, which were of rap singers, particularly ones who had been killed. And it looked like he was on the verge of getting sort of deal in those. But he had gone through all of Amanda's money. The was suddenly broke, jewelry pawned, and pregnant with Grant's child.
At the same time, we have Laura, who is, you know, had some very troubled times in her life, but she's on the upswing in her life. She is working with, she's met a friend through, I believe, Heidi, named Oksana, who's an artist, and they have this little agreement going on that they're going to be able to work with each other. And Laura has some art of her own that she's finally coming into her own and doing her artwork.
She started a business.
So go ahead. Tell us about the upswing in her life.
Yeah, she started a business with Siobhan Mathis. It was a very simple thing. They had two people they were selling to. One, they were selling restaurants on the idea of using the paper placemats with ads on them in their restaurant, and they would get free placemats for that. And the other side was selling businesses ad space on these placemats. And so it was going really well. I mean, starting out any business is a little difficult. She had her graphic arts business on one hand and then this restaurant marketing business on the other. And Siobhan Mathis was her partner, and they were working and building up a clientele list and having a success that was building every month, and things were going really well. On her personal life, she had gotten a place of her own. She had worked a part-time job until she got the business off the ground, and she was taking care of things in her personal life and making herself a stronger person, so that she could be the best mother she could be. She was very, very determined to be a good mother and to provide everything she could for her boys. She wanted them to have a better life than she ever had. And she was making great strides towards that. She had a mentor, and she was getting advice there. She was involved in it. Everything in her life was looking up in 2011.
Now let's talk about what her real wish was in terms of the children. Just for the record, was her idea to get full custody? What was Grant's idea? What was her idea? And what was the dispute in terms of why were they going through this custody battle? What did she want? What did he want? Because it will be important to the rest of this story.
Yeah, he really wanted full custody. He actually wanted her to just go away. He didn't see why she was important in the boys' lives just because she was their biological mother. He had another woman who could be their mother, and so that should be good enough for the boys. He did not acknowledge anything having to do with her importance in their lives. And he and Amanda wanted to travel whenever they wanted to be free to move to Nashville where he could sell songs he had written. And they thought that the children should be able to travel with them. It wouldn't be right for them not to have those opportunities. And Laura was just standing in the way of all this. Laura, on the other hand, felt that for any child, both parents play important roles in their lives. And she wanted to have an equitable and pleasant sharing of the raising of the children. And the more signs of instability that Grant showed, the harder it was for her to want to actually share custody with him. And the psychologist was doing the work on writing them up, and things were not looking good for Grant to even share custody. Although she pointed out some character flaws in Laura, which Laura took on and was willing to work to make herself a better person. Grant, on the other hand, was actually pretty furious. He wrote on his copy, he wrote all sorts of notes, and they were anger and resentment and style. And he really just wanted the kids all to himself. And his idea was, my children, she was basically only the vessel that brought them to life. And he didn't see any reason why she had to be such a nuisance in his life. But when he was looking at that report that he got from the psychologist, he knew he was in deep trouble. That looked like very possible that Laura was going to get full custody of the boys.
Yeah, he wrote on this folder, which they found later in the truck, it said notes BS and never to the conclusion
in that.
Yeah, because
he was saying that Laura was crazy. And, you know, he was the normal and stable one. But the psychologist was looking at all of this and saying, yeah, Laura has some emotional problems and that she needs to work on. But she also, Laura said, I really would like to have ongoing drug testing for both of us because Grant's got a bad history and a long history of drug abuse. And she put that in there. And she's, you know, when she testified in court, she said, well, it was because of Grant that I wanted that in there. And so it was a very hostile situation. Nonetheless, in June, when Amanda was about to give birth to her child, Grant was really, really nice to Laura and asked her if she would, you know, take the kids for a week or two so that Amanda was about to give birth. And, you know, Grant could be very, very nice when he wanted something from you. But no sooner were those kids with him than he was being nasty to her again and telling her she couldn't have her Wednesday night visits at all, even though the psychologist was saying that the boys were so little they needed to see each parent more with a greater frequency of rotation. He wouldn't let her have any midweek visits with the boys. And the excuse he gave was that she was too emotional in saying goodbye to them. And she shouldn't have to kiss on them and hug on them. She should just walk away.
What was the relationship between Amanda and Laura, for the record?
It was a strange thing because, on the one hand, Laura felt her boys were a lot safer because Amanda was there watching over them when they were with Grant. On the other hand, Amanda had been fed a one-sided version of life by Grant. And she thought that Laura was psycho crazy and told her so. And so she always had this really negative view of what Laura was up to and what she wanted and that she was crazy because she was believing what Grant told her. And so they would try to get along and then there would be a lot of friction. You know, at one point, Laura even wrote a thank you note to Amanda for taking such good care of the boys. But then Amanda would come back and tell her that the kids were sick all the time because you don't take care of them right. And And yet, Laura wasn't doing anything wrong. Yeah, she took them out and let them run in the little sprinkler fountains that they had in the park, in, which were there for children to run in, but Laura thought that was wrong. That would give them colds. And whenever Laura thought there was some serious health concern with the boys, Amanda, again, would say she was just crazy. So it was nothing nothing Laura could do could shake Amanda the feeling that Laura's crazy. And so everything she said was under question.
The most puzzling character, I think, here it obviously is Grant, but also it's a very complex character that Amanda has. This person that, you know, inherits this money from somebody she was married to that had an unfortunate accident, a swimming accident where he's paralyzed and dies. She inherits this money, not through any kind of gold digging or anything. She's had her bouts with celebrity herself and talent. She's a little bit of an actress. She takes some official training, but doesn't really get any big roles. So she's a talented person, good-looking woman. But Amanda is listening to the kinds of delusions that Grant is saying quite often in the home, and some of the behavior that he has, which is leans towards at least, or is can characterize as violent. And yet at the same time, she is more supportive of what Grant is saying versus what Laura is saying. She really is on his side, or at least sucked into his charisma, or at least on his side, isn't she?
Yes, and Amanda had an adult daughter from her first marriage, and her marriage to Grant was her third. And she... Her adult daughter, when she found out this strange life philosophy that Grant had about the aliens and the secret place to go to be for the special bowl, she said something to her mother. She said, you know, boy, is he serious about this? Or is this a joke? And Amanda says, no, he's very serious, and it would make sense to you if you came from the place where he came from. And that really, really struck Shay's pretty odd, that her mother would be so accepting of this wacky theory of life that Grant had, and this sense that... everybody was out to get him because he was a black man.
Right. Now let's go to just previous to the day in question, July 13th, 2011. And let's talk about what Laura was doing and who was she corresponding with. Because right away her behavior is, when it isn't in character, people are alerted. So let's tell us, just what was Laura doing on that day? What was she supposed to do? And was there any, what was the event that was supposed to happen that day? And tell us who in Laura's circle was in contact with her that would notice anything was amiss.
Well, Laura was doing a lot of business calls that day. She was sort of heading from Kinston in the direction of Raleigh and making multiple stops along the way. And all along, she was calling back to Siobhan and reporting on her success. And she was having one after another after another. She was having a fabulous day business-wise. She was supposed to meet Grant at a kid's place called Monkey Joe's in order to visit with kids. And her appointments kept being longer than expected because they were all being successful. she was running behind schedule, and she had to change the time. And Grant said, well, the boys, I'll need to take the boys home so you can come here to my apartment, and I'll pick them up. Now, Laura normally did not go there. She knew that it wasn't a good idea, and it is unclear why she felt okay going there. Was it just because she wanted so much to see her boys, or was there some sort of promise made to her by Grant in order to get her to the house? Some people that know her well have said that the only way she would have gone there was if she thought she was going to come home with her boys. And no one really knows exactly what was in her mind when she went there. In all likelihood, she had a little tape recorder that she taped all her conversations with Grant on it, and downloaded it to her computer every day when she had one. That disappeared along with Laura. So we don't know what kind of things Grant could have said to her to get her to come to that apartment. Just was not anything anyone who knew her thought she would do.
Now, right around soon after this, the next day, is it Siobhan that goes to the police in a short order and reports her missing? Tell us who reports her missing and how do police proceed.
Well, Siobhan was just walking distance away from Laura's apartment. She walked up there, and it was a gated place so that she couldn't get inside, but she looked in and was able to see that Laura's car was gone. So she assumed Laura wasn't there, and she's sending her text messages, she's sending her emails, she's telling her friend, I'm worried, get in touch with me, please, right away. And the fact that she wasn't answering her cell phone was a huge concern to Siobhan, because Siobhan knew that Laura always kept that cell phone on, always answered it in case it was something about her little boys. And she knew she would never turn it off. So that was very troubling. And she waited for a couple of days of being unable to reach her. And finally, on Sunday, she got the police to go to the apartment. And Laura was not there. And she filled out a missing persons report on that Sunday in Kingston, North Carolina. Meanwhile, when Heidi finds out that Laura's missing, Heidi lives up in Raleigh. And so she goes to her computer and she gets a CD disc and a flash drive and fills it up with all the material from a special mailbox that she and Laura shared, and it was where Laura used it for it to repository all the messages and the recordings and everything else that had anything to do with the kids and the custody fight. And she took that information first to Kingston and reported that the last place Laura was in Raleigh. Then she also dropped off in Raleigh. When the Kingston police found out that Raleigh was her last location, they briefed the Raleigh Police Department, and it was the Raleigh police found Laura's car.
Now, just for the record as well, from Heidi and from Siobhan, her two closest friends, Did she tell them specifically that Grant was violent and she felt threatened or her life at risk at all by Grant?
She told him if anything. She told Heidi if anything ever happened to her, Grant did it.
Right.
Siobhan knew there was a custody battle, knew there was bad blood between them, but she really didn't know a whole lot about Grant himself. She did know that Laura was devoted to her boys.
Right. Now, right away, and most, as we know in these stories, and fictional and otherwise, that there's only the people that are most up on the suspect scale are people closest to the person in question. So let's sort of fast forward this a little bit in terms of what does Grant Hayes do? What's the first thing he does do officially? What does Amanda do? What does the family do? Tell us how they proceed in the next, say, 48 hours.
There are many trips to Target and Walmart. There's typical salt purchase. There are the purchase of coolers and garbage bags and gloves. And then there is a rental of a U-Haul vehicle. There is a piece of antique furniture that Amanda says we need to load up and take out to my sister. She said that it was because she thought that Grant had sold everything else she had of value, that might be next. It was a fine piece of furniture. It was a castle antique, so it was very valuable. And but what no one knew she was taking out there, in addition to that, were coolers that were full of body parts.
Now, the thing is, they have, what we talked about is they went shopping, so we know that from videotape that he went and got duffel bags, he got goggles, plastic tarps, industrial trash bags, and the very, very important reciprocating saw and certain blades, and duffel bags a little bit later, and a little bit later as well, they get muriatic acid. So tell us what the police do find at the house, or pardon me, maybe we'll go backwards here, sorry. Let's talk about, because very important, Amanda's daughter, Shay, and what she knows and what she is witness to.
She knew that Amanda and Grant were having to move out of their apartment before they were evicted. They said their plans were to move in with Grant's parents down in Kinston. And so she knew that was going on. And when her mother asked her to come take care of the boys, get them out of the house so that we can get some packing done, she did it. She had, aside from the fact that her mother took a piece of furniture that actually she considered to be something that would one day be hers, and turned it over to her aunt, that ticked Shay off a little bit. Shay also, when she found out she was going out to visit her aunt, wanted to go along, and her mother just told her she was selfish for wanting to do that. And so Shay was not aware of what was happening in that home, but she was aware that there was a lot of chaos going on. And she was angry at her mother for not including her in the trip out to see someone who was a very important part of her life growing up. Then when the police came, and told her that they were looking for her mother. And did she have any idea where she was? Well, she told them that they went to Texas. And so the police decided they needed to go to Texas too. And they passed Grant and Amanda returning to North Carolina without knowing they were passing them while they were on their way out to Texas.
When police do finally get around to looking at the residence, the former residence of Amanda and Grant, what is the one thing that is telltale and they notice immediately and is of interest?
The bathroom in the hallway smells of cleaning materials. It is spick and span and immaculate as if it was never used. There are no rugs. There's no shower curtain. There's nothing in there, hardly at all. It's been completely cleaned out. They ask Shay about that bathroom. And she said, well, that's the one the little boys use. That's the one that's always full of their bath toys. And yet there was nothing in there. It had all been moved to the other bathroom. And that didn't make a whole lot of sense. And she didn't understand it. And of course, at that point in time, the police didn't know what to make of it.
There was also the bleach stain at the front door, which was of interest to the police as well.
Yes, there was a very large bleach stain on the carpet right by the front door, just before it turned to tile. And it was very large, and it was very unexpected in that spot, because that's not a spot where you would normally think that you'd even have bleach. I mean, yeah, you might use it in the bathroom or the laundry room or the kitchen, but not by the front door. So that was very suspicious right away. And Shay had said when she came in the house, it smelled like bleach. And that didn't make any sense to her, because bleach always gave her and her mother such horrible headaches. So it didn't make sense that her mother was cleaning with it. Her mother never cleaned with bleach. So with every piece of information the police got, it became more and more suspicious.
Now, on their trip, they go to see Amanda's sister, and so it's Karen Berry. And this is the most fascinating part of this story. It really is incredible, some of the dialogue in this. And again, of course, with my imagination, and others will be reading and conjuring up the same images. So tell us about the meeting with her sister and the kinds of questions that they're asking. Again, innocent questions to some, but the kinds of questions they're asking of the sister and her son, and I guess she has a couple sons, so tell us what kind
of
questions they're asking.
She has a couple of grown sons, and Amanda and Grant are asking them, since one of the boys has a business of removing feral hogs from people's property, ask them if hogs will eat human remains. And then they have a long conversation about that. And then they get to, well, aren't there alligators in Oyster Creek? And won't alligators eat human remains? And the boys sort of thought, oh, these are just city people that don't know anything. You know, Grant's just a city boy and he doesn't know about this. And Grant also asked them about going shark fishing, and then they want to know about any deep holes on the property, and they ask about the septic tank, and They ask about the well and all sorts of strange things. And poor Karen, this is her little sister, a much younger sister, and she can't quite wrap her mind around what is going on and what might be happening. I think she's had the red flags waved in her face, but she's just torn. I mean, this is her sister. Her sister couldn't be meaning what she was saying is what she's thinking. But she was getting increasingly uncomfortable with them being there. And then there was the fact that the boys were with them, and both of them mentioned that they had been told they can't take the boys out of the state, and here were the boys. And it was getting increasingly uncomfortable, and she basically just was so relieved when they finally left. Soon after they left, the police show up. And that's when...
Sorry, go ahead. Well, the thing is, what we just skipped over a little bit is what exactly Amanda did say to her sister. What question was asked, and what did she tell her sister? Very, very, very important. So what was actually said to her sister, and what was the circumstances?
Karen finally asked, what the heck is going on? And Amanda said, I hurt Laura. I hurt her bad. Karen didn't really want to know anything more. And Amanda and Grant took the family's boat out onto Oyster Creek at night, late at night. And then returned. And Karen knew something really bad was happening, but she didn't really know what. And she didn't want to believe what her common sense was telling her. And it wasn't till the police got there that she finally admitted to herself and to them that she thought Laura was probably there, and the place they should look is in the creek.
She also said to Laura had, or pardon me, that Amanda had said to her, or pardon me, that Karen had said to her, are you just covering for Grant? And she nodded her head, yes, which is quite important.
Yes, she did. She did, but the question is, was Amanda telling her sister she was covering for Grant in order to tell her sister what she wanted to hear, or because it was the truth? That was the big question.
Sure. Now, like you say, police are there shortly after. This is not much of a trail here if this is a master plan. She says, can I pray first? And then she tells them everything that she knows. She's just a very honest person, doesn't want to be burdened with this thing at all. So now, how do police proceed once they have this information?
Well, they send divers into the creek, and they even have a man with a gun in a boat in case alligators approach. But it turned out the biggest problem that the divers had were with the lily pads that were covering a big portion of the surface of the creek across the street, and they had to keep pushing them aside all the time. And the water was deep and dark, so dark that they were literally doing like snow angel motions on the bottom of the creek to try to find body parts. They were mostly hoping to find her foot, since she had a tattoo on it, and that would identify her quickly. But they never did find any of the feet. They did find leg parts. They did find body parts. And then ultimately, they found Laura's head.
They also, Karen had also grabbed a machete that Grant had and secured it, wrapped it with a rag and put it in the garage and kept some other things that at least that the police had, didn't know what their evidentiary value were, but they grabbed like over 100 items. And,
yeah.
Of course, they were looking at autopsy to confirm that these parts of a torso actually were Laura Ackerson. So now, so how do Amanda and Grant, what do they do in the under these circumstances? What happens?
They returned to Kinston, and they were at Grant's parents' home when the police came and picked them up. And the police questioned them and charged them with Laura's murder as soon as they knew they had Laura's body. And then it got excessively weird because Grant claimed all he was doing was protecting his wife because his wife had gotten into a fight with Laura and caused her to fall and hit her head. And Amanda was saying she didn't even know that Laura was dead until she arrived in Texas, that she didn't know Laura's body was sitting in her guest bathroom for a couple of days while they were going about normal family life, so to speak. She was there alone. She never looked in that bathroom. She never checked anything out. She was oblivious, according to her. But none of that seemed to hang together too well. That's a little too hard to believe, that there could be a body in your bathroom and it was cut up into pieces and put into coolers and you had no idea that it was there.
They separate. At first they're jointly charged, and then, of course, he wants to put the blame on her, and so they're separated, and so he goes first, and his trial is first. Now, tell us, again, what I find fascinating about this is that there is some really good lawyering going on here. When in the first trial with Grant, the address to the jury from the defense is quite good. It's quite convincing. And yet that you get the prosecution's address to the jury, and it is even better. But very, very interesting, because this really explains the first-degree murder charge, the malice, premeditation, planning, and deliberation. And really, this is the crux of this case, because it ends up being quite a circumstantial case, really, despite all this physical evidence. So let's talk about what the defense for Grant Hayes is. What is their theory? What do they try to put across to the jury? Tell us a little bit about that.
They are trying to convince the jury that, yes, Grant was guilty of the body, but he did it only to protect his wife, his family. He had nothing to do with Laura's death. He was out of the room when the fight started. He didn't know what was going on. He came in and Laura was on the floor. And the defense was adamant that this is just a man protecting his wife. The prosecution, on the other hand, had not only the evidence of the emails and text messages that Laura had saved, but they also had Laura's journal about it, and they had the history between them and how badly that had gone. And they also had the report of the psychologist who said that Grant, in all likelihood, had a personality disorder and he needed to be seeing a psychiatrist to address that issue and identify which personality disorder it was, whether it was antisocial or borderline or whatever. And that was very damning information that was presented by the psychologist. And to me, one of the things that was most chilling in that courtroom was when they played a song had written about Laura called Broomstick Rider. And it was a very hate-filled song about threatening to kill her. And it really showed where his heart was. And the whole time that song was playing and the jury was listening to that song, Grant was sitting there at the defense table, just bebopping his head to the music, like he was really enjoying listening to that hateful invective that were the lyrics of his song.
Yes, yes. Now, what was really important, too, and really part of his not-so-defendable defense is that supposedly this woman that was always fighting for custody for her children, that loved her children more than anything, went over to his home because she was going to sign a document. Now, tell us about the details of this document, because, again, this is very, very important in this case.
There was a document that was found in his apartment that was signed by Laura, and they did have handwriting specialists verify that it was Laura's handwriting, where she agreed to give up custody of the boys in exchange for $25,000. It said that she would be able to see the boys with the permission of Grant Hayes. Now, number one, Grant and Amanda no longer had any money, so they didn't have $25,000. The other thing is that no one that knew Laura believed that she would take and give up custody for any sum of money. But she signed it. My theory on the case, which the prosecution tends to believe too, is that there was some coercion used that night. Was the nick they found on one of her neck bones because a knife was held to her throat? Possibly. And why did she seem to have received the fatal blow right there where that bleach stain was by the door? I think that what happened was that Laura did what she had to do at that moment, couldn't resist the temptation before she left that apartment of reminding them that she had a tape recorder and she had everything that was said that night and everything that happened recorded on that tape.
Interesting.
And that's why she died right then and there.
Now, we won't have time to go through the entire trial at all, but suffice to say that there was two separate trials, both pointing fingers at each other, trying to claim that they weren't the murderer. They were just a part of the disposal of this woman, with Amanda having, of course, claiming to have much less of a role, and unbelievably, really, for a lot of it, where she didn't know this and she didn't know that, she didn't look here, she didn't look that way, she had no idea. And so it seems quite implausible, basically. His trial, again, we just talked about his demeanor, where he's enjoying listening to his murderous lyrics in his tunes, which seem to be eerily, and that's why they were admitted into the trial, that they had some relation to his character and his feelings for his wife, Laura. So tell us about the outcome of the first trial, and then, I guess importantly, what happens with the Amanda's trial.
Grant was found guilty of first-degree murder, and he was given life without parole. He has since gone through the appeal process and lost. Amanda, on the other hand, the defense did manage to put some doubt in jurors' minds about how much she was involved, and she was convicted of second-degree murder. And she will probably get out of prison after serving 14 years.
Interesting. I think that the prosecution, though, was really, I think they were, dead set on having them both convicted of murder. And I think, given the limitations that the case presented for them, that they still did exceedingly well. But it seemed that the prosecution really was, if they really had to focus on anyone, they really wanted to make sure that Grant Hayes really went down for this murder, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And I do think that they were probably equally complicit, and because of the way everything was carried out and the fact that Amanda, while Grant was out shopping and things, was home alone and could have called the police and didn't. She was aware of what was going on, and she was an active participant in what was going on. So I think she got off easier than she definitely deserved. But at least she did have to pay a price. And Amanda will spend some of what could have been the best years of her life behind bars. And there is some justice for Laura Ackerson.
Patsy Grant, Patsy Hayes had some letters from Amanda. Again, you talked about the character of Amanda, and we talked about the plausibility of her story and her complicity in this murder. Tell us, because she appeared in Amanda's trial, Patsy Hayes had letters that Amanda had written to her that she could convey some of that letter to Grant in prison. So what was the contents of those letters?
She was sending messages of love through Patsy to Grant, because two people sitting in jail cannot write to each other when they're...
Right.
Co-defendants, so to speak. And so she was constantly talking about how much she loved Grant, how she wanted to see him, making suggestions to him about meditating and things of that nature to keep his head on straight, and extremely supportive messages that if she hadn't known what he was up to every step of the way, it's hard to believe that she would have been that way. I mean, if she was totally innocent, surely she would have been outraged at what he had gotten her into. But there was no signs of that, none at all.
You don't really point the finger, but it's nice that you show and not tell. She asks the same questions as Grant does. She wants to know about the gators and the eating of the bodies, and so these are beyond the realm of questions you would ask under any kinds of circumstances, regardless, aren't they?
Yeah, and she's there for the little walk around the property, trying to find a place to dispose of the body, like the septic tank. And, how can you do something like that to your own sister? How can you wrap her up in something like this and put her in such a horrible, horrible position? And no one wants to get up on the witness stand and testify against their sister and say such horrible things about her. But Karen had to do that because she knew it was the right thing. And she didn't want to be there. She didn't want to be in that courtroom. She didn't want any part of it. Who would? But Amanda did that to her and put her there and compromised things with her own daughter, Shay, too. It's just unbelievable the callousness that Amanda showed to everyone around her who cared about her at one time.
But we also have to remember the king of all manipulators is this Grant person who had a folder on his computer and calling Laura a hoe and diminishing her role, even though she was the mother of these children. He made the choice to be with her. It just seemed that when he found someone else to use, then this person was trash. Now, he sucked all the money out of Amanda and just in time to get her into, you know, a life of, in prison. So this person is really, and no loyalty towards, it seems, anybody. And yet at the same time, he's been charismatic enough to con every single one of these people, and their loyalty is incredible if you really think about it.
Yes, and but the other side of this to remember is what Shay said. That's Amanda's daughter, Shay said. She said, everybody points to Grant and says he's the master manipulator. But what they're forgetting is that in Amanda, Grant met his match. She was every bit the manipulator that he was.
Wow. So he's finished with his appeal processes. How close did you come? Did you make any effort? What was their response? Did you reach out to either one of these for any kind of interview? And what was their response?
Yeah, well, you know, when I was working on the book, Grant had an appeal coming up, so he certainly did not want to talk to me. And Amanda, I got no response. No response. I didn't even get a call back from her attorney. So, yeah, a lot of times you just can't get through those barriers.
Very interesting, too, that the loyal friends, Oksana and Siobhan and Heidi, were really prominent in these trials and helped as much as they could and offered as much as they could and very good and reliable witnesses when they were called upon, weren't they?
Yes, they were. And it has got to be such a horrible, horrible thing to not only lose your friend, but to have to get up there in the courtroom, not once, but twice, to relive all of this misery and grief again. You know, it's the loss is horrific enough, and you once it happens, you hope to try to heal from it. But these women, they couldn't do that. They didn't have time to do that. Things just kept moving and moving, and they had to be there to testify at Grant's trial. They had to testify at Amanda's trial. And they really paid a price of friendship, and they stayed with their friend Laura to the bitter end for as long as it took.
Now, what about Patsy Hayes and her husband? What was their position through this? Are they still loyal to their son? And you can also tell us where the two boys and, of course, the Lily, who was the offspring of the child from their marriage, Grant and Amanda. Tell us where those children are and who's taking care of them.
The three children are all together with Grant Sr. And Patsy Hayes. they're raising those three children, and you know, they're grandparents. This is a tough road to hoe for them. And on top of that, they lost their daycare center because once the news of this crime spread out, no one wanted to bring their children there anymore. It didn't no longer felt like a safe place. So they lost their livelihood. They lost their son. And now they're raising a whole nother family. And it's like they're starting all over again.
Yeah, incredible. And do you know, is there any talk about what has happened with the boys and Patsy or anything? Is there any other stories in the follow-up? How big was this story in the media? And was there sort of a diminished interest once the trial was finished? Tell us a little bit about how important or big a story this was in the media.
The story was huge, particularly regionally. There was a lot of coverage of it. There was also a lot of coverage up in Michigan, where Laura was originally from, and out in Houston, where the bodies were dropped. It was big news, but once the trials were completed, it sort of faded out of the limelight, as those things usually do. And Shay, who knew Grant, little Grant, and Gentle very well, and had taken care of them on multiple occasions, she is living out west now, but she is the half sister of Lily, and she takes that extremely seriously as a responsibility, and she always makes it out for the joint summer birthday party. The three children have kind of close together birthdays, and so they all have one big party for all three of them. And Shay is always there for that. She wants to continue to have a major role in little Lily's life. And I think more power to her. Lily has lost both of her parents to incarceration, and is at least for now, as orphaned as the two little boys are. So it's good that she has her half-sister in the picture.
What's fascinating about your book, too, is that normally we have one trial, and sometimes we have plea agreements, but we have two full-blown trials here. And the thing that normally doesn't happen is the defendant taking the stand. And with the case of Amanda, she does take the stand and makes for some very riveting and interesting reading, because of course there's always something trotted out through the defense, through your own lawyer, and then a able-bodied prosecutor can really savage that flimsy or
the prosecutor was amazing. I mean, Amanda got up there with her sweet little girlish voice and was talking sweet and kind of breathless and telling this story of her victimization by Grant. And the prosecutor got up there and she just was like a terrier. She wouldn't let go. And finally, Amanda snapped at her and showed her true nature on that witness stand. And it was pretty amazing cross-examination and very revealing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, you've painted a very interesting portrait and very very vivid portrayal of these two characters, especially. Well, and Laura as well. Laura and Grant, Amanda, and this confluence of events, and the daughter Shay, and the friends, that the loyal friends, and this just two parallels, two people on the same trajectory, but people that were trying, Laura was desperately trying to rebuild her life and go in a completely different direction. And these children were just like a tug of war between this psychopath and his desires and Laura's, and came to a tragic end. Very, very incredible story. I want to thank you very much, Diane, for coming on and talking about your latest, Bitter Remains. For those that might want to contact you or see your other work, do you have a website that you might direct them to? And you do Facebook
as
well.
Yes, I'm on Facebook, and I'm also I have a website, which is dianefanning.com, and I've got sample chapters of my works on there, all 14 of my true crimes and 10 of my novels, and they can take a sample of that there and read about each one of those books.
Yeah, that's fantastic, Dan. And thank you again for coming on and for always, like always, a great interview. And as always, a fantastic book, Bitter Remains. I want to thank you very much for coming on. And I know I'll be hearing from you again soon because you're a very, very prolific author. So I'm sure you've got something in the works right now as we speak.
I most certainly do, Dan. I wouldn't let you down.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Diane, and hope to hear from you again soon. You have a great evening, and thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Bye-bye.
Good night.